study those words on your own, which we appreciate you looking at that. For a number of reasons, you learn better when you're looking and listening. And also you can keep an eye on me to make sure what I'm teaching is what's actually in there. So we finished up last week, chapter 9, with Peter doing some incredible acts of healing in towns outside of Jerusalem. We saw him heal the 8-year paralytic. He brought a Tabitha back to life from the dead. And he used these situations not for his own glory, but to enable people to see the truth concerning Jesus Christ. And that was always the critical issue. If you remember one of the very first Sundays I was here, I said the critical issue is, what will you do with Jesus? And that is always the issue. What will you do with Jesus? Will you accept his atonement for you, his work for you, or will you try to create your own system that justifies you in God's eyes? It's I would suggest accepting Christ's atonement as opposed to trying to create your own justification. We're not that good at it. For those of you who are married, your husband or wife could confirm you're not that good at it. And we need the grace that God offers us through Jesus Christ. These healings were verifiable. The community, the culture saw them and knew what happened. If you should come across people claiming the power to heal today, make sure it is verifiable. There are many false imitations out there. Usually money is involved. If money is involved, it is likely an imitation, not the real thing. Peter, these guys, they didn't heal to get physical power, to get physical wealth. They healed out of compassion to fulfill the Great Commission. Today we're going to look at some verses that will be a challenge for us to understand. It's a challenge to us to understand for a number of reasons. One of them is that we are so well versed in our Western tradition, especially a post-Reformation tradition. We hold the idea, or we think we hold the idea in the post-Reformation tradition, that the salvation is offered to everyone. That we like to say it's a free gift based on the atoning work of Jesus Christ. It covers our sin and enables us to have a right relationship with God. We claim the sufficiency of Christ for all of our offenses. Therefore, there's no need of the law, no need of special acts to justify us before God. But this was not so to the early believer. The book of Acts, while detailed in some areas, does not give us the in-depth chronological progress that goes on in the growth of the church in the early years. More time has passed in history up to these incidents than we normally think. Since they're condensed in just a few chapters, we think that they happened with just in a few weeks or months or a year or so. Remember the ascension of Christ. He commanded his disciples, and by disciples I mean those who were to carry on the work of the kingdom of heaven to the world. He commanded them in chapter 1, verse 8, if you remember. But you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes on you, and you'll be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in Judea and in Samaria and to the ends of the earth. So this was the task that they had to do, or they should be doing. Do you guys remember when we talked about time, we said that it seemed like there was 2 to 3 years passed before Stephen was stoned, okay? So that's a certain amount of time, more than we usually think. And then we have a certain amount of time passed. Then we have Paul saved, and then he goes to Arabia, right, for a couple years? So we are now somewhere between 6 and 8 years after the ascension with these events that are going on. This has been a while. So you would have to ask yourself, based on the Great Commission, what we call it, how are we doing? How are they doing? How would they grade themselves? How would you grade them if you were going to grade them? In organizational systems for companies, sometimes you have what is called a dashboard. Is anybody familiar with that kind of idea? It's a system where you use to measure the effectiveness of your organization or the vital signs of your organization, your dashboard. They use that term because you have a dashboard on your car that shows the vital signs of your car, your vehicle health, oil pressure, temperature, speed, voltage, even whether you have your seatbelt on. I don't know if it tells you yet whether you brushed your teeth, but, you know, it's pretty exhausting these days. it shows these kinds of measurements. So if we were to apply that kind of tool to the disciples in terms of what they were commanded to do, we would give them what kind of grade? It would depend on what part of the Great Commission that they were told to do. They were very exclusive. For Western non-Jewish people, it's hard for us to imagine how exclusive they had become. We see glimpses of it in our culture, and we may feel it in ourselves at times. It's not a very healthy feeling. It's not a very healthy body that is that exclusive. But sometimes we go there. But it's not all inclusive in an organized religion like they had. So let's look just for a second at the Great Commission, and we'll use our little dashboard example to grade them. And as grades, we'll just use colors. One of the things they use is, like, if you're doing well, you get a green color, and if you're not doing well, it's a yellow, and if you're doing terrible, it's a red. So there were a couple parts to the Great Commission. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem. So if you were to grade the Jewish Christians on whether they were being witnesses in Jerusalem, you know, if we were being generous, we could give them a green, right? They're doing pretty good. They have been sharing the truth of Christ in Jerusalem. And then in all Judea, that was part of what they were supposed to do. And they've kind of been spreading out in Judea. They've been getting that out there. That's home, though. And now comes the kicker, though. So now it's Samaria and into Samaria. Remember that they're not really fond of Samaritans. In fact, remember when the guy walks by, you know, the wounded, you know, I mean, they're not going to touch anything unclean. They're not going to touch Samaritans. They don't. When Jesus told that and made the Samaritan the hero, they weren't exactly thrilled with the Samaritan being the hero. They didn't really like them. They don't like them to this day. 2,000 years later, they still don't like them. So in terms of going to Samaria, you know, it seems like they'd gone a little bit up there, kind of pushed the border a little bit. So maybe they get a yellow for that, you know. And then into the innermost parts of the earth, they're not really going out there doing really well, reaching out at that. They simply had no heart for the lost if it went beyond the Judean borders. They had a heart for the lost in Judea, but beyond that, not much of a heart. So how does God take us from complacency of where we are with only a heart for ourselves and our people to a place where we would reach out? Do you guys remember when I first started teaching each Sunday, I would tell a little missionary story about, do any of you remember those? I know you know, and maybe I'll just start those over someday because I have them all written down. But, you know, these are people who understood the heart of God to go out everywhere at any cost. They understood it better than the disciples did because they were not bound by this cultural allegiance that was so crippling for them to do what God wanted them to do. So they settled into a culture, and they were viewed at the time chiefly as a Jewish sect. They weren't all that upsetting to the Jewish national scene, except for at specific times. So they are now in the position where God is going to try to get them to go out further. Once again, we have to think that these commands are so culturally shattering to this exclusive people that they are going to move slow. And then, of course, I thought one word of warning. We might pat ourselves on the back and say we're not like that. So we went through Matthew and we're now in Acts. I've said it a few times and nobody's beat on me yet for saying it, but we are the religious people of our day, right? We are the ones who hold these same tendencies to be exclusive, to be proud of ourselves as they were. I think if we were to look more closely at our own sharing of salvation, we'd find that we still somewhat have this general pattern. It's easier to share with our family, our friends, people we know. It's harder to share the further out it gets. I haven't seen too many people signing up lately to go to, you know, Iran as missionaries, which is what these guys did. They got so bold, they would just go into the worst places and just get her done, you know. We want to be a little more comfortable than that, I suppose. So after all this, now they come. God is going to try to move them further. And how does he do it? How does he move any of us from the comfort of our own zone to having great compassion on others? We'll start in chapter 10, verse 1. At Caesarea, there was a man named Cornelius, a centurion, in what was known as the Italian regiment. Caesarea is on the coast. We talked a little bit about it. It's a little further up from Joppa. It's kind of in the Samaritan zone, but the coastal Samaritan zone. It's where Pilate lived. It was a Roman. One of these, there are more than one Caesarea, but it's one of these Caesareas. Caesar, that kind of, you know, named after Caesar, that was a popular thing to do. So I don't know if we're going to rename the town, Soldotna, to the new governor. I don't know if we'll do that. But back then it was profitable. You know, you got more money and things and gifts and prestige. So this is where they lived. And the centurion, and we, most of you know, centurion means that he was in charge of 100 soldiers, a unit of Roman soldiers, pretty impressive unit, to keep Jewish rebellion down. Italian regiment means that they were, most of them were from Italy, and they were sojourners or in that time in the military in that area. Verse 2, he and all his family were devout and God-fearing. He gave generously to those in need and prayed to God regularly. That's quite a statement, actually, for somebody from Rome to have this kind of dedication. If you notice, it says he was God-fearing. It's just a general name for God. It's not the specific names that the Jews had for a identifiable God. He's not that yet. He was devout. There's four things it lists. He feared God. He gave generously. And he prayed regularly. This guy had come a long ways from the background that he came from. I tried to do a little historical research on where the Romans mindset would be coming from. Most of you know that the Roman world, you're familiar with the Pantheon, right? That building with the little niches in it for every god that existed. Although they didn't have that many niches because there were a lot of gods back then. But the idea of monotheism, worshiping one God, praying to one God, is totally alien to the Roman culture. They practiced polytheism or pantheism, which is what the Roman approach to deity was. I think you can realize if you believe in pantheism or polytheism, you know, many gods, just any particular god that you wanted to pick, this is quite a task to know what gods would want. Do you pick the god of the land where you live, the god of that particular idea or concept? You could kind of pick a god that suited your pleasure and identify with him. Now, we don't pick another god. We just change God's characteristics, right, to be the characteristics that we would like to be. So for him to come this far, to move from a polytheistic worldview to a monotheistic worldview, was a long ways, but he still had no knowledge of Jesus Christ. It reminds us a little bit of the Ethiopian in the previous couple chapters, traveling, right? He believed in God. He had a scroll that gave him some information about God, but he did not know specifically about Jesus Christ. But apparently, we can learn from this that God pays attention to what we do. Verse 3, one day about 3 in the afternoon, he had a vision. he distinctly saw the angel of the Lord who came to him and said, Cornelius. Cornelius stared at him in fear. What is it, Lord? He asked. It reminded me a little bit of what we just saw when Paul was confronted. Remember when Paul was confronted? Who are you, Lord? I mean, I don't know. I like to think Cornelius is a little sharper than Paul because he doesn't say, who are you? He just says, what is it? What do you want? But that's just the way I was looking at those words. So it's the same phrase. You know, they want to know what they should do, what he should do. And then the second half of that verse, it says, the angel answered, your prayers and gifts to the poor have come up as a memorial offering before God. In the polytheistic view or the pantheistic view, God may be infinite or he may not be infinite, but he's bigger than you and he doesn't necessarily care about you. The whole idea of Christianity from a Jewish viewpoint and then a Christian viewpoint is that God is both infinite and personal. I don't know how to stress how big a deal this is to our existence, that God is both infinite and personal. It's easy to believe in an infinite God. Romans says, by looking at nature, the bigness of God, of the universe, we can know that God exists. And I think of a friend of mine who said he attended college and he took, I think it was a microbiology class, and by looking at the smallness of the creation and the complexity of the creation, he came to a belief that God had to exist. This could not have evolved. So it's easy to say that God existed. And that is where this man, Cornelius, had gotten himself to. But it's a little bit lonely to know that he exists, but to not know that he cares for me. And that's the next step that we want to go to. Does he care for me? Is he taking me to a point where he just doesn't exist out there? Because we could believe that like a Greek god or a Roman god existed and toyed with us or did things to our emotions. But does he have compassion for me? Does he interact with me? And that's another step in our growth. And it's certainly another step for Cornelius to learn here. So God is both infinite and now he is personal to Cornelius. In verse 5, excuse me. Now send men to Joppa to bring back a man, Simon, who is called Peter. He is staying with Simon the tanner, whose house is by the sea. So he gives him some instructions, tells him what he wants him to do. Joppa is a little bit south from Caesarea, so he's sending him down there to get him to come up. Now it's interesting. I don't know why God does what he does, but it seems like the biggest challenge here is to get Peter ready. Do you understand what I'm saying? The biggest challenge is to get Peter ready to go there. Not Cornelius is ready to hear. The Lord has prepared his heart. He is ready to hear. But the challenge is to get this religious guy, this disciple, this critical disciple, to obey, to have the same heart for the lost that God has. Once again, if we applied it to ourselves, probably the world may have a lot more needs than we desire to go meet because we don't have the heart to share sometimes as we should, or we're too doubtful, or whatever the reasons are that we struggle to share the truth with others. So he gets the instructions, and then, of course, the nice thing is he follows the instructions here. When the angel who spoke to him had gone, Cornelius called two of his servants and a devout soldier who was one of his attendants. And he told them everything that had happened and sent them to Joppa. Remember earlier it said in verse 2, all of his family were God-fearing. So he led all of his family to the same mindfulness of God, even though he didn't have a clear definition of Jesus. Also giving you an idea that as being part of your family, you can influence your family members, and those who are around you to a mindfulness of God by being faithful to that yourself. I think in that situation of many personal applications, you may be able to think of some yourself, people who have influenced you or you've seen them influence others by being faithful. They don't balk or say, hey, you know, this is dumb. And they just go because of the faith of him. We saw the faith of the Ethiopian go down and start an Ethiopian church that continues to this day. So he's willing to obey. Once again, he's more willing to obey than Peter is. And this is not the way it should be, by the way. So now we go to verse 9. We shift from the personality of Cornelius back to the personality of Peter. But Peter has to overcome not just ignorance, he has to overcome the limitations of his previous religious experiences. And that is the challenge sometimes. Our previous religious experiences limit our ability to obey the Lord because they weren't really God-centered religious experiences. They were pretty much man-centered. Verse 9, about noon the following day, as they were approaching the on their journey, approaching the city, Peter went up on the roof to pray. So he's preparing. God has one party ready to do what he wants. Now he's preparing the other party. Peter went up to pray. I thought, you know, I give advice from time to time here. I thought praying to God is a good time to hear from God. Does that make sense? I just thought, you know, if we never take time to pray to God, how would we hear from him unless he appears like Paul and yet like he did to Saul? But this doesn't seem to be the general, you know, he doesn't appear to everybody that way. I sort of wish he did and I sort of wish he didn't. I'll leave it up to you to decide. But anyway, he's taking time to pray. Verse 10, he became hungry and wanted something to eat. And while the meal was being prepared, he fell into a trance. So he is thinking of food. Now, when we think of food, we think of, you know, whatever is on the agenda in our culture for food. But of course, if you know Jewish law, the agenda for Jewish food is a little different than the agenda for our food. They were very limited in what they could do and what they could eat, what they couldn't eat. There are all sorts of rules and regulations, when, how much, what kind of animals. So he fell into a trance, and by a trance, I just think it means he was thinking so intently on this spiritual things while praying that he kind of lost focus on the physical around him. You may have done that sometimes yourself, where an issue is so critical that you are completely thinking about things that are not physical, which is probably a good thing to do on occasion. And then verse 11, he has a vision. You know, he saw heaven open and something like a large sheet being let down by its four corners. So he sees this thing coming down. Now that would be interesting. Naturally, you want to see what's inside of this thing that's coming down or what's on this thing that's coming down. And in verse 12, it contained all kinds of four-footed animals, all as well as reptiles of the earth and birds of the air. Now he has to be a little curious of what the purpose of this is. And then look at the next command. Then a voice told him, "Get up, Peter, kill and eat." Now, even for me, if depending on the reptile, I might not be too interested in killing and eating, but it wouldn't be a religious concern that I was trying to avoid. It would just be a personal preference. But for him, there are things on that sheet that he has never been able to consume in his entire life. Let's say that there is a nice slice of bacon on that sheet, or at least in whole form, you know. I mean, I don't know. Does anybody else like bacon? You know, I'm not the kind who can dip it in chocolate and that kind of, just give it to me straight, a little crispy. It is so good. You know, forget chewing tobacco, just a little bit of bacon between cheek and gum. I'm a happy boy, you know. And I don't have bacon very often, but I really like it. But he couldn't have that. And there are so many things he couldn't have. These were rules and laws given to the Jews that separated them from the rest of mankind. These were the things that made them distinct. It made them different. To start partaking of these things would take away the distinction that they felt. And you guys remember Peter's character when we were in Matthew? I mean, here he is, face after being one of the critical believers, doing incredible things. And here he's going to tell the Lord that the Lord is slightly mistaken, right? I mean, this is his thing. Look what he says there in verse 14. Surely not, Lord. This is not what you mean. I'm misinterpreting this, you know. And I don't know if you've ever had that experience yourself. You felt the Lord calling you to do something and you're like, not me. That's not me. I don't have the confidence to do that. I can't speak up here. I can't say that. I can't do that. Surely not, Lord. Partly, though, because of his cultural background, this was just something that you did not do. And even though they had seen Jesus break some of the social norms, remember these things? And they broke some grain. These guys had broken some grain on the Sabbath. Do you remember that? And I don't know how they ate it, but they ate it and they got criticized for it. So they'd kind of cheated a little over into this not following this stuff to the letter. But I have never eaten anything impure or unclean. That was according, of course, to the law of Moses that he's following there. I've never done these things. Reminded me of the rich young ruler a little bit. All these things have I kept from my youth. I have been without fault. And the thing is a lot of these people could say that truly. It was true. We are probably not quite that disciplined. You know, there are many things we would say, I have never done this. And if it is, it's because, like, I don't like, you know, Brussels sprouts or something. I have not eaten Brussels sprouts since my youth. I'm doing good, you know. But that's not what we're talking about here. And then comes the response. The voice spoke to him a second time. Do not call anything impure that God has made clean. So God is trying to correct him, to prepare him for what's coming. Because this is coming down the road right now. While he's experiencing this, they're approaching the property with a proposition that he is not going to like. It's not going to fit with his cultural background. Do not call anything impure that God has made clean. This happened three times, and immediately the sheet was taken back into heaven. Does it strike you anything about Peter in three times? You know, this is not the first time that Peter's had to hear or see something three times. We saw him deny Christ three times. We also saw the Lord ask him, do you love me? Three times. A little slow on the uptake, this gentleman. I thought that maybe we could have shirts made. I'm a three times believer, you know. A little slow, you know, something like that. I don't know that anybody would wear them, but it might be good for us to wear them. And now this has gone up into heaven, the sheet, and he's back to wondering about the meaning. In verse 17, while Peter was wondering about the meaning of the vision, the men sent by Cornelius found out where Simon's house was and stopped at the gate. You notice God's timing is pretty good. I mean, he does this pretty well. Right when Peter's at this critical issue of understanding this, they knock at the gate. They called out, asking if Simon, who was known as Peter, was staying there. In verse 19, while Peter was still thinking about the vision, the Spirit said to him, Simon, three men are looking for you. So he got up. Get up and go downstairs. Do not hesitate to go with them, for I have sent them. So if you could couple these things together in Peter's mind, you would understand that he is facing the idea that God is preparing him for something that's outside of his normal experiences. He's going to have to make a decision to reach out. Remember, back to our little dashboard illustration, they are not doing good at reaching out to the lost. They are doing good at reaching their own little cultural group, but they have no compassion. Remember when we studied Jonah? No compassion. Jonah had no compassion for the lost. He was very content that they should die by the millions or the hundreds of thousands rather than that God should reach out and save them. We don't want to put Peter in that same hardness of heart, yet at the same time, he is limited by his cultural outlook. We are limited by the limits of our thoughts in terms of God's compassion for other people and God's action for other people. While Peter, in verse 19, while Peter was still thinking about the vision, the Spirit said to him, Simon, three men are looking for you, so go with them. And Peter went down with them in verse 21 and said to the men, I'm the one you're looking for. Why have you come? Verse 22, the men replied, we have come from Cornelius the centurion. He is a righteous and God-fearing man and respected by all the Jewish people. A holy angel told him to have you come to his house so that he could hear what you have to say. Then Peter invited the men into the house to be his guests. Because hey, this is the first step then, right? Look, he invited what appear to be Gentiles into his house. So he is passing step number one, even though he struggled with the idea of kill and eat. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about how far to apply this next Sunday, but for now, we're just going to stay with the flow of what is here. He invited them in to be his guests the next day, so they spent the night there. The next day, Peter started out with them, and some of the brothers from Joppa went along. The following day, he arrived in Caesarea. Cornelius was expecting them and had called together his relatives and close friends. And then look at verse number 25. This is a critical verse for Peter's growth, for the change in Peter's life. So look, let's first look at what God had done. He had prepared Cornelius over time, changing from a polytheistic view or pantheistic view to a monotheistic view, believing in God but not having a good definition for him or any knowledge of Jesus. Then he had gone and he had prepared Peter to be able to take this huge step to minister to these people that had not been ministered to by anybody. Now, Cornelius, who is prepared, has gathered together a small congregation of people to learn these critical truths about Jesus, which were not known. And now comes the fact, is Peter going to follow the leading and reach out to people who are not Jews? Or is he going to resort back to being an exclusivity type person who says, I know I have a faith that I'm just not simply not going to share with just anybody. But remember, God has compassion for all of his creation. He doesn't just have compassion for a few. He has compassion for everybody. And I love it said very simply, but verse 25, as Peter entered the house. Peter has never entered the house of a Gentile. He has never stepped over that threshold. He has never moved to show God's character and compassion to a non-Jew. After 5 to 8 years after the ascension, do you not find this a little hard to believe that he had never reached out? He had never shown compassion? This is what religion does to us. It makes us very limited in our compassion. Doesn't that seem strange? Does anybody know any non-compassionate, judgmental Christians? Maybe a couple at some time in your life you've come across? We have to be careful that our love for God and our desire for truth, our desire to take a stand and not compromise in some areas doesn't make us a religious, judgmental, harsh people. we need to make sure that we have the heart of God, and the heart of God is to reach out with righteous acts to all of his creation all the time. This is what he's doing. And if it's what he's doing, it's what we should be doing too. So we saw Peter entered the house. I'd like to put that in capitals, you know, because I just think it's such a huge statement. Cornelius met him and fell at his feet in reverence. But Peter made him get up, stand up. He said, I am only a man myself. Does this not show some growth in Peter? He doesn't desire to be honored as some special person. I am only a man myself. And that should apply to all of us as believers too. There is no hierarchy in God's kingdom in terms of believers. There's God and all the rest of us on the same line, seeking him, hopefully passionately. Talking with him, Peter went inside and found a large gathering of people. I don't know how you would view this next statement if he came into your house and said, if I came into your house and said this to you, you probably wouldn't view it all that well. It's still a little bit harsh. It reveals a little bit about Peter's attitude, that the cataclysmic decision he's trying to make here in terms of caring and believing, actually believing that a Gentile has every bit as much worth as a Jew in God's eyes. He said to them, "You are well aware that it's against our law for a Jew to associate with a Gentile or visit him." So, you know, I mean, that's not a very good greeting. I'm not supposed to come in this house. But on the good side of it, he says, "But God has shown me that I should not call any man impure or unclean." And that is a growth point for Peter, right? He is willing to go there. Now, he might have could have said it nicer. But what the truth is he's starting to understand, to get the idea that all men are equal in God's eyes because of what Jesus did. Because remember, because of Abraham, they still felt that they were chosen above the Gentiles. "So when I was sent for, I came without raising any objection," which is not quite true. Because he raised a little objection when the sheet came down, right? I mean, you saw that. "Hey, just a minute. No, I don't think I'm going to do that." But I don't know if that would, we'll talk a little bit more whether that's a word picture for him to think about or whether that's literal. But as for now, we're staying with the flow of this section. And he says, "I came without raising any objection. May I ask why you sent for me?" And Cornelius answers, and we'll look at the answer just briefly today and then pick it up next week. 4 days ago, I was in my house praying at this hour, 3 p.m. Suddenly a man in shining clothes stood before me and said, "Cornelius, God has heard your prayer and remembered your gifts to the poor. Send to Joppa for Simon, who is called Peter. He is a guest in the home of Simon the Tanner, who lives by the sea. So I sent for you immediately, and it was good of you to come. Now we are all here in the presence of God to listen to everything the Lord has commanded you to tell us." I don't know if you've studied missionary stories a lot. I've tried to. And there are a lot of missionary stories from this time until now that are similar to this. A person seeking a definition of God. They have an idea of God, but they don't have a good definition of God. For most of you who have been believers for a long time, do you not still seek a better definition of God? Isn't this part of what we're doing? We're trying to seek a better definition of God, what he would want or what he wouldn't want from us. We don't believe that we're earning merit by getting that better definition. That's not the issue. It's just that we're more able to operate in this world as God would want us to if we have the correct definition of God. "I don't suppose if any of you ever have a poor definition of your spouse or someone you really care about, what they really want in life. And you do for something for them and they look at you and go, 'Did you do that for yourself? Because it wasn't something that was meaningful to me.' Has anybody ever?" Don't raise your hand, but yeah. I mean, the fact is we can only think the thoughts that we have thought. That's pretty basic, isn't it? But how does God get us to think thoughts we haven't thought? Through his Spirit, right? He convicts us to think through his word, through other believers who have grown in areas maybe we haven't. I think Peter's a pretty intelligent guy. He has a serious heart for the Lord, but the Lord is still trying to stretch him. So he has the heart and mind of God. A true understanding of what Christ has done and how it is offered to everyone, so that he can then be instrumental in taking this gospel beyond the borders of Judea. If you were a sales manager and you would assign these guys to be salesmen, and that's as far as they'd gotten in their coverage in 7 years, you probably wouldn't give them a raise, okay? You would think, you guys have not really covered the territory very well. But God is not in a hurry. He knows what he wants to accomplish. And He is very persistent. Have you noticed that? He is very persistent in all of our lives. So think of Peter. Think of his growth. Apply it to your own lives as much as you can. But think of how earth-shattering this was to him. But then it's the start of something even bigger, which we'll look into next week. Let's pray. Lord, you're very, very good to us. And you're always reaching out to us. Help us to learn to enjoy you, to have a good definition of you, which we will be able to continue through this life with a little less desperation than we may feel at times without a good definition of you. Thank you for your love and consideration and your word. In Jesus' name, amen.